Willkommen zu Max und die Supply Chain Helden, deinem Unternehmer-Podcast zum Thema Einkauf und Logistik im digitalen Wandel. Gedanken, Erfahrungen und vor allem Erkenntnisse aus dem Bereich Supply Chain Management, ganz ohne Beratermission. Einfach verständlich, eben aus Unternehmersicht. Ich bin Max Meister und wünsche euch viel Spaß. Welcome to a new episode from Max and the Supply Chain Heroes. Today I have an English-speaking guest and I'm very happy because today Robert C. Walcott is here and he is a co-founder of Twin. I will come back to that later. And he's adjunct professor of two of the world's leading universities in innovation. And also he's a venture investor and a venture investor. Sorry. Rob, we met during the Twin convention, I think 2 years ago. In London. And it was the first time that I attended that event. And you started a speech with a story. It was called Proximity and How Difficult Is It to Buy a Matching Fork? And I was very interested. And maybe you can start and tell us more about Twin Global and also about the topic of proximity and the matching fork.
Great. Well, thanks, Max. It's great to be here. And since we met over almost 2 years ago, the proximity revolution has just continued. And we can get back to that. But quickly about Twin, the World Innovation Network, to be honest, it's just a spreadsheet I have with a bunch of people I've met in the world or referred to me whom I like, who are broadly curious, entrepreneurial, and ethically grounded. And I don't know about you, Max, but when I meet people who have those three characteristics, I want to spend time with them. Life's more exciting, it's more fun, they take smart risks, they're out there, they're curious about everything, and they really want to see the world become better. And so that's what Twin is. But regarding the matching fork, honestly, that's a little thought experiment I invented to help people understand how profound this transformation is that we're going through right now. And this proximity transformation is something that is not just, you know, a fad for a few years. It's a trend over many decades. And we can unpack that during our conversation. So the story of the fork, I asked the question, think about today how hard it is to buy one matching metal fork. It turns out it's actually really hard. What we do traditionally is we mine iron ore in Western Australia, we put it on a ship, we send it to Southeast China, we melt it down, alloy it, send that to another plant, we make 12 matching forks, we put them in a box, into a pallet, into a ship, across the Indian Ocean, to a port, to a train, to a truck, and then to a store, and I buy 12 matching forks. Mm-hmm. That's the old model. Now, think about today with 3D printing, it's actually trivial to download a design file, push a button, and print one matching metal fork. One metal fork to order. In fact, Max, if you want a picture of your kids on your fork, that's technologically trivial. Upload the picture of the kids, and magically, you've got a fork with a picture of your kids on it. Now, here's the punchline for me. There's never been a demand planning team in the history of humanity who sat around saying, how many of those forks with a picture of Max's kids should we order from China 9 months in advance and hope to have them in inventory? That's never happened because technology allows us to do things that we could never have done before, and that's where we're going.
And now all of my listeners that also follow me on social media know that I wrote about proximity, but all the listeners know why your five sentences about this fork and the example really resonated with me, because you are describing some part of my business. And this was very interesting. And today I'm happy because you wrote a book. It's called Proximity. And the subtitle is How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, and Daily Life. And this is the main topic. But I wanted to tell the story how we met and why I was very intrigued by the stuff you were telling at the convention or at the meeting we had with Twin Global. When we come to the book, I have a couple of chapters that resonate very well with me, and I would describe it as a book for visionaries. So that means it really should give us a vision what is maybe possible in 10, 15 years. And I did not care if I was thinking about stuff. Ah, but here is a problem, and this will get difficult. So that's not the story of the book. How would you describe it if you want me to read it? Yeah.
Yeah, great. So a couple things about proximity. It's important to know that the book is predictive. What Kaihan Krippendorf, my co-author, and I are not saying is, here's something that some cool companies do. You should do it too. You'll make more money. We certainly are seeing lots of cool companies doing this, but that's not what we're saying. We're not saying that you should do this. This will be great. What we're saying instead is, this is where every industry is going the rest of our careers, and it's predictive. And and that sounds hyperbolic, but when you understand the premise of it, you start to immerse yourself in it, you see it everywhere. So this is something that's been going on for some time now. It's not brand new. We just haven't noticed it. And here's the punchline, Max. So back in 2014, I was really getting going with venture investing, putting my own money behind startup entrepreneurs, working with entrepreneurs, and also doing some public market investing. And I thought, you know, we need some better foresight as to where the world is going to go. We can't predict the future in detail, but we can see the contours of the future. And that's what led to proximity. So I asked a question I learned in my academic background in economics, which is something called the general purpose tool. So a GPT in economics, unrelated to generative pre-trained transformer, that's a wonderful thing, but that's totally unrelated. So a general purpose tool in economics refers to a technology or set of technologies that can be applied across an economy. And when you see how that is different from the past, you can actually start to see the future. And so the question I asked back in 2014 was, what is fundamentally different about digital technologies compared to the industrial age? And by digital, by the way, we mean all sorts of digital. We certainly mean mobile apps and AI, but we also mean 3D printing, rooftop solar power generation, controlled environment, agriculture, anything that is digitally enabled. And what you realize when you look at digital compared to the industrial age is digital allows us to compress capabilities in smaller and smaller packages and distribute them all over the economy, ever closer to each moment in time and space. So therefore, digital compels value creation ever closer to the moment of actual demand. And by the way, Max, we're not just talking about a little bit better supply chain management. That's a great thing. We're not just talking about responding faster to customers. Everybody wants to do that. We're literally saying that digital over the rest of our careers will compel the production and provision of value ever closer to the moment of where it will be demanded in time and space. And that's proximity.
Yeah, I understand that that's the basic concept of proximity. For me, maybe we have to come back to the question, but yeah. For me, it was some kind of difficult to see on some hand digital development, but proximity really gets into a very interesting concept when you combine it with physical production. Yes. Because I think everybody knows examples like streaming songs on Spotify or Apple Music. That's also some kind of proximity because you get the product right at the second when you want to have it. But I think, and that's why it's maybe, for me, it's a world-changing concept, is because you combine it with real physical products and
right.
physical processes. And that's why it's so interesting and so powerful, my point of view.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, proximity adheres for products, services, and experiences. It adheres for digitalized content. It adheres for physical products. But of course, as you've pointed out, Max, it operates differently. It rolls out and evolves differently in each of these contexts. And I'll give you an example. So you mentioned streaming. If you think about video streaming, video content is already 100% proximate when it comes to the provision of that content. So you can go to Netflix, Disney Plus, YouTube, name your poison. And you can see whatever video you want anywhere, anytime. By the way, that's not necessarily a great thing. You can binge watch the Kardashians as much as you want. So Kaihan and I are not proposing this is Nirvana. But nonetheless, you have 100% proximity of video content already in the provision of that content. But you do not have the production of that video content proximate to demand yet. Mm-hmm. So the content was created months ago or maybe even decades ago, But where are we right now with generative AI? We're at the knee of the curve. We're at the very beginning of being able to generate video content on demand. And eventually we will be, this is not I wonder if, this is going to happen, video content generated on demand for an audience of one. So video content for exactly what it thinks Max wants to see right now, which is different than what Rob wants to see in a particular context. So this is definitely where we're going. And so what you see is provision of video content is already 100% proximate. And over the rest of our careers, video production of video content will become more and more proximate. Now, you mentioned something to me even more exciting, I agree, which is physical stuff. So digital stuff already travels at the speed of light. So you could see why that would be proximate. But it's coming for physical products too. I mean, a lot of people, a few years ago, there was a big fad around 3D printing and everybody said, oh my God, it's going to change the world. And of course, just like all disruptive, transformative technologies, it's hyped and then it collapses. A bunch of companies lose a lot of money and people say, oh, see, I told you, that's never going to work. Well, guess what? People are starting to figure it out. There's a steep learning curve. People are finding value-added applications for additive manufacturing. It's percolating at the peripheries, and over time, it's going to get better and better. We know it's not going to get worse. It's going to get better and better, and over time, it's going to change the game. And when you can 3D print anything, anywhere, anytime, and that's the essence of proximity, then you can procrastinate. You can wait until there's a specific customer for a specific product with specific characteristics and make that custom product at the moment of demand. And so we'll be able, as a result of proximity, to break trade-offs between customization and efficiency, customization and cost. And that's where we're going.
And that's the reason why I like the book, because even though with some of the outlooks or with the what you see in future, maybe I do not agree, but you can see what areas may change, what boundaries will go away, and then you see maybe there is a chance to see an option or a chance for the future. And I think that is why it's important. And I also like that you make very bold long-term predictions, because making predictions is, I don't know if you know the quote by Scott Galloway, predictions is a horrible business, because if you're right, everybody says, ah, very obvious. Yeah. But yeah. and if you're wrong, everybody says, I told you. So, yeah. But I think it's important to think about bold predictions. And that is why I think the book is not only for supply chain geeks like me or people that work in startup businesses and are looking for new business models. I think it's also interesting and to plant some thoughts for every manager who thinks about the future and stuff like this, because it's not about agreeing, it's about starting to think about what is possible or what could be possible in future.
I totally agree. And by the way, I don't know if you noticed, Max, but in the book, so Kaihan and I avoid making any date predictions. Mm-hmm. So we don't say this will happen by 2030 or 2025. We don't say that. I have no idea how fast they look. When ChatGPT came out in November of 2022, it shocked all the experts, including myself, as to how good it was. And that, by the way, is a quintessential expression of proximity. Before ChatGPT, you needed to agonize away for hours in front of a blank screen to write a speech, for instance. Now you throw a prompt in and seconds later you have a marginal speech. Now you've got to edit it. You've got to make sure it's what you want. But we had no idea how fast that was going to be. So we don't make date predictions. And second, I actually disagree a little bit. There are some things about when you're trying to predict the future. There are some things you can actually see before it happens with great confidence. So I'll give you two examples. The simple one, I already mentioned video streaming. When Reed Hastings and Mark Randolph had the idea for Netflix, they didn't have to do a focus group to find out if humans would want to watch whatever video they want, wherever, whenever. That's obvious. I mean, you really don't have to, I wonder if humans would want to watch videos. Of course they will. So if you start from what humans want with no holds barred, you will see the future. The question is, how will we get there? And in a world where technology can increasingly do anything, eventually we will get there. A second example in AI is now, as we know, starting to become better and better at coding. You can be confident that knowing how to code will become less and less pivotal. It'll be more and more like knowing ancient Greek. And this is something I wrote about in Quartz in 2017. And a lot of people said I was an idiot. But a lot of other people said, you're absolutely right. This is where it's going. It's going to go further and further toward interacting with us as human beings as opposed to having to know how to code. And, of course, that prediction's coming true because you could see it. You could see it happening, and I wasn't going out on a limb. It's just people have a hard time seeing around their current paradigms.
Yeah, because they do not try to see. That is why I think it's very interesting. Maybe to give the audience some examples, I have been to a local spices distributor yesterday. Okay. And I watched him how they do business, and today they import a lot of spices worldwide, and they sell it here in Germany. It's a niche market, and they are a market leader. And they told me about regulation and stuff like this, how it's getting. Sometimes the first kilo of one spice costs 2,000 euros because of all the documents they have to create. And the next 100 kilos of the spice also cost 2,000 euros in total. So a very unproximate. They purchase from the world and then they distribute all over the German-speaking market. And I was thinking, again, sitting there, was very interesting how they do the business. And then I was thinking about the chapter from your book, How We Eat.
Yeah.
And maybe you can give two examples of the vision that you too have seen or you were thinking about or could envision for this area, for proximity-wise, for the future.
Great. So There's a lot of activity in something called controlled environment agriculture. You might think greenhouses, but it's way beyond that. And frankly, in most cases in the world, it's not economically viable yet. And the fundamental challenge is once we have proximate energy, proximate power, we'll have proximate agriculture. That is the key. The key to distributed proximate agriculture is proximate power. Now, set that all aside, there are some examples already that are working. So one is a company called Bustanica in the UAE, in Dubai. It's not far from the Dubai airport. It was a partnership with Emirates Airlines. They grow the lettuce and leafy greens they need for their flights in this building a few miles from the Dubai airport. And they use 98% less water. They waste almost nothing. The traditional model, we waste a third of all food grown in the world, goes to waste, entirely to waste. And they don't have to do much demand planning because with the traditional model, you grow the leafy greens in Spain or North Africa, you harvest them in advance, put them on a ship, send them to a warehouse, hope you have the right product in good shape when you need it. With the model they're using now at Bustanica, they grow only what they need, where and when they need it. And the lettuce that I had on my flight back from Dubai to New York recently was picked in that facility the night before. So it's a completely different model. And just to underscore, Max, how powerful this has become for Emirates Airlines, they announced in April of this year, after we finished the book, they announced in April this year that they're buying the whole company. So they have acquired all of Bustanica, and they're figuring out now how to start to roll this out to other parts of their network. Now, an even more exciting example, because frankly, I invested in them, and they're just knocking the cover off the ball. It's a company called Interstellar Lab, based in the US and just outside Paris as well. A French entrepreneur, a friend of mine, Barbara Bell VC, whom I think you met in London, And back in 2018, she called me. She said, Rob, I would like to figure out how to grow food on Mars. And I said, what? It sounded like you said grow food on Mars. And she said, this is what I said. So I said, no, I'm not going to invest in that. I don't have a 60-year time horizon. I'm not a billionaire. but she was sort of, she knew I wouldn't invest in that. But she had just gotten a big grant from NASA. And her objective from that grant is to figure out how to grow food on spaceships or eventually when we land on Mars. And that process has advanced extraordinarily well. In fact, Interstellar Lab earlier this year was selected from across 300 different companies. Interstellar Lab was selected as the one to provide the technology for growing food in the spaceship and the test missions that are going to go up a few years from now. So that's doing well. But Barbara also knew she needed a business here on Earth. And this is the one that I invested in Interstellar after she shared this model with me. It's very exciting. So they've created pods. And these pods are about the size of a room. And they can be installed in manufacturing facilities. And her company manages them remotely. So they've got, they're collecting data, analyzing growth patterns. They're optimizing the growing conditions in these pods for each individual plant. And so why is this powerful? Well, she and her team made a list of all the very high value ingredients derived from plants. All the very high value, very low volume ingredients derived from plants. And what industries use these? Well, certainly pharmaceutical and biotech, but also skincare, fragrances, cosmetics. And guess where Interstellar has their facility? Outside Paris. So it's perfect, right? So her clients now are Firmenich, Robertet, the largest ingredients company, L'Oreal. So L'Oreal is installing these pods in their manufacturing facilities to create, to grow mission-critical plants, plants that have, from which are derived ingredients they must have to produce their products. And frankly, they have supply chain challenges because of climate events, because of geopolitics, because of what's going on in the Red Sea, for instance. And now that L'Oreal is installing these pods in their manufacturing facilities, they produce exactly what they need, where and when they need it, and they are completely absolved of geopolitical challenges. They are completely absolved of climate-related risks. They get exactly what they need, where and when they need it. So to your point, Max, I could imagine at some point maybe somebody like your spice distributor saying, what are some really high value-added spices that I might be able to grow right here in my facility and have complete control?
And you really only produce what you need and not
exactly.
Maybe a half a year in advance plan what you try to sell on Christmas. So.
Absolutely right. Think about this, Max. The easiest demand to predict is one that already exists. The easiest demand to predict is one that already exists. So the more and more we can push ourselves to wait, to procrastinate until we know exactly what we're going to need and then produce and provide it, the closer we are to proximity and the closer we are to the most efficient economy possible.
When did you start writing the book or collecting thoughts about proximity?
Oh, great. Well, like I mentioned, the question arose in 2014, and I didn't know that proximity would result from it. But the question was, what is fundamentally different about digital compared to the industrial age? How does it work? What does it allow us to do or not allow us to do? And that question then by about 2015-16 led to this insight which became proximity. So in around 2015-16, I started looking at different industries. I then later on during COVID, I connected with Kaihan Krippendorf, my co-author, and he started getting excited about it. And so we reached out to experts in a whole range of industries. So Max, as you know in the book, we look at how we work, how we eat, how we create and produce, how we prevent and cure, how we power and how we defend. And in the final chapter, we talk about virtual reality and space, which by the way are 100% proximate environments. And so for each of these industry-focused chapters, Kaihan and I took a first shot at writing the chapter and thinking it through from an industry perspective. But we didn't want to worry about being idiots because, you know, nobody knows everything. So what we did is we reached out to a couple of super experts that we know in the world in each of those industries. So how we work, we reached out to John Breeman, the head of innovation for Willis Towers Watson, the biggest HR consultancy and insurance brokerage in the world. In food, we reached out to a friend who was actually part of building that facility in Dubai that I mentioned, Bustanica. So we connected with people who really know energy or really know manufacturing, for instance, and we had them read the chapter and comment on it and say, "Hey, you guys are crazy. This is wrong," you know. And we made changes. So we worked with true experts with vision who also have vision to explore each of these industry areas.
And the good thing, at least I imagine is a good thing, is where when you start talking about proximity and how the world changes, is if everything is produced right in the right amount at the place where it is needed, yeah, then you attract other people that are interested in this topic. And even though maybe it's not the same thought, but you get some kind of experts that want to discuss about how the world is changing. If, for example, in healthcare, we can be we can find more proximate solutions.
Yes.
What are the consequences? So I think it's very, very interesting. The example also, it was presented how small batch medicals are produced in Africa.
Yes.
And how the labs are changing, and how it's not necessary anymore to have huge facilities to be cost efficient. This was also a very interesting speech during the Twin Global meeting in London.
Yeah, thanks, Max, for bringing that up. The founder of the company is called Bio Usawa. We don't talk about it in the book because, frankly, he wasn't very far along with it when we were finishing the manuscript. But Dr. Mengus Bairu is one of my heroes. He's from Eritrea. He moved to the United States years ago, became extraordinarily successful in biotech and pharma. And a few years ago, he said, "You know what? Nowhere in the African continent do we produce monoclonal antibodies, much less biotech in general." So he said, "We can solve that." So the punchline is Bio Usawa, which is already incorporated in Rwanda. They have their first facility opening in Rwanda soon. They have perfected the technology to put the ability to manufacture monoclonal antibodies into basically two container trucks. So take two container trucks, you put everything you need in the labs to do this, you drop them in site, and within a matter of months, you're actually producing monoclonal antibodies. And so they're starting with Rwanda, they're gonna open also in Ghana, and their objective is to distribute these production, small-scale production facilities closer and closer to demand all over Africa. And their objective is by 2030, they want to be producing enough monoclonal antibodies for all the demand, to meet all the demand in Africa. And then after that, their objective is to start to export the stuff. And so this is a dramatically different production model than we have in the United States or Japan or Europe, where we, as you said, Max, we have large production facilities, high process control, very expensive. He's created an extraordinary model that is allowing Africa to leapfrog all of us, and we need to learn from it.
And I like the example because this is the biggest critic I get when I talk about proximity, because today we live in a world where you have highly standardized big production facilities for, I don't know, iPhones or whatever.
Yeah.
And it is also in my mind sometimes very difficult to think about how a small-scale, very flexible production close to the customer could ever be a cost costly attractive for the customer. So this is whenever I talk about proximity, and I always use the example you just mentioned from Africa, that it could work, but I think this is, it's very difficult if you think about your daily job to really, you called it leapfrog, but
yeah,
to find the right step from the today's world maybe to a future model.
Yes. Well, you bring up a great point. What we're not proposing in the book is, hey, manufacturers, get rid of your traditional manufacturing and go 100% 3D printing. Of course we're not proposing that. But what we are saying is for an established enterprise, look across your supply chain and see where do you have the biggest risks? Where are the things that if something goes, if there's a tsunami in Thailand and you can't get access to the chips you need, for instance, and that's happened in the past, as you know, look across your supply chain and see where are your biggest risks and where does custom responsiveness have the most value? Guess what? You can do that stuff today. You can start to do that with 3D printing and related technologies in a way you could never have done a decade ago. And so the Interstellar Lab example with L'Oreal is a perfect example of that. L'Oreal still has huge manufacturing facilities, and they will for years and years because it makes sense. But they'll also have these small-scale production capabilities distributed closer to where they need things because it makes economic sense. And so just to illustrate quickly, the last couple of years, Ford Motor Company in their annual reports have reported a dramatic increase in the number of parts, hundreds of thousands of parts that they are making right now with additive manufacturing, because it makes them more responsive and it saves them money and makes them more efficient. So this is how it's going to start, Max. People are going to find value-added, real business applications for these technologies. They're going to learn, they're going to get better, and over time they'll rise up and change the game. It's classic disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm. And I have done this argument that you just said a couple of times because I tried to promote the book because I think it's interesting and it's a different point of view. Before maybe we make one step closer to my industry, when I read the book, my question was, you were thinking about it now for more than or for close to 10 years.
Yeah.
Do you have aspects that if you would start today, you would emphasize more, or your focus would be more important, or maybe some things already changed a lot, or maybe a ninth chapter. So during maybe the promotional tour this year, is there something that you said, okay, maybe this is a very, let's say, maybe a topic for the next edition of the book?
Oh, yeah, great. Well, as you start to watch these things, you see what's percolating at the edges. And this is true of all emerging technologies. There'll be hundreds, even thousands of companies that fail, die horrible deaths. But some of them will rise up. And one of the companies I've been following for a while, and they've been successful for some time, so this is a little bit different example. But a company that's publicly traded, you can look it up, it's called Axon, A-X-O-N. Mm-hmm. The founder is a crazy guy, brilliant guy named Rick Smith. He's just like Tony Stark, you know, from the comics, right? He developed a better taser years ago, founded the company in 1993, I believe. He developed a better taser in his garage in Scottsdale, Arizona. And that became a taser company, originally called Taser. And then over time, Axon always asks, what will my customers need if they could have anything they wanted? And their customers are police forces, security forces, et cetera. And they don't say what technology exists now that we have that we can make better products. They do that, but they really ask the question, what will my customers want in the future if they could have anything? Mm-hmm. And that gives them foresight and vision that other companies lack. So I'll give you an example. They started with tasers. Then they pioneered police body cameras, you know, where police officers walk around with a body cam to record situations. And they are by far the leader in that in the United States. They're collecting all these data. They're analyzing all these data. They're sharing the analytics. And then later on, when generative AI popped up, late 2022, 23, they already had in their vision, back in 2017, they had a vision for AI filling out police reports using body cam data. So they already had that in their vision. And then when ChatGPT launched, they said, aha, now it's ready. And so they put a team together. And earlier this year, they launched Draft One. Draft One takes, if the officer wants to, they push a button and it automatically fills out police reports. Now, I know how much officers love filling out police reports, so maybe they won't want to do this. but imagine the efficiency improvement. Imagine how much more time police officers can spend doing their job the mission they signed up for than filling out police reports. And meanwhile, Axon was looking at drones. So they started partnering with drone companies. They knew nothing about drones at the beginning, but they started partnering and they had a little internal team managing it. Well, earlier this year, they announced they're buying two drone companies, and they are by far the leading company in drones in public security and safety. Mm-hmm. And if you look at their share price, Max, in public markets, they're up 800% in the past 5 years, and I don't see that stopping. It's been an extraordinary journey. Because they asked that question, Max, what would my customers want in the future if they could have anything? That's the question we all have to ask.
And that's also a topic in the book, because proximity helps companies to think about customer centricity and really think about what does the customer want, what does he need. So that's a very good example. And here also proximity helps maybe find new segments or niches where you can find solutions for your customers that you were not able to, problems maybe you were not able to solve today.
Yeah.
One more question. So I'm very curious about all the topics. So it's I have to focus on the.
By the way, Max, I love what you do, and I love the fact that you've got this very important universe of people who stand in the middle of entire industries and move things around to get stuff where and when people need them. And there's nothing more relevant for proximity than that. So I've valued hearing from you and learning from what you're seeing in the marketplace.
Yeah, and so thank you, Rob. In Germany, it's one of the biggest segments, and also in the US, the wholesale distribution, it's a huge segment. But it's also a very traditional segment, and talking about innovation sometimes feels a little bit clunky, I would say. So it's difficult to really be thought-provoking so that the people start to think about new stuff. But one more question. If you think about proximity and you talk and you have a company like Shein, you know the fabricator. I don't know if I pronounce it right, but
Shein or Temu?
Shein, Temu. So on one hand, they have some kind of proximity because they are very close to the demand, meaning they have a low low stock level. But on the other hand, they are the opposite of proximate because they are very far away. And it's a shame for the nature how they bring the products from Chinese factories to the U.S.
Yes.
What is your take on companies like Temu and Shein proximity-wise?
Right. Well, a few things. They're actually great examples to think through because the punchline is they are using, in some cases, current technology to find the demand and match it with supply, but they're combining it with industrial age technology. And the industrial age technology is, frankly, manufacturing facilities in China that have extra capacity in it, right? So, and I have to say, I'm not a fan from a sort of environmental perspective. It's a horrible thing. If you look at the cargo jet traffic between China and the United States since these rose, it's been dominated by small packages flying because somebody in Omaha, Nebraska really needs that cheap sweater, okay? Now, look, I get it. It's a free country. People should get what they want where and when they want it. But setting all the environmental issues aside, which are huge, setting those aside, there are a couple other things going on with Shein and Temu, one of which I think will be resolved in the next few years. It's going to be a challenge for all of us, and that is, as your listeners probably know, there's something in trade law called de minimis. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., if it's under $800 of value, it could be, but it's around that, then there are no tariffs. So every time they send that one sweater to somebody in Omaha, they're not paying any import tariffs. So that's an extraordinary advantage. But I think that's something that's going to be dealt with in the next few years, and that's going to be a huge hit to their performance. But the other thing is, like I say, what they're illustrating is there's an enormous demand out there for anybody who can get consumers what they want, where and when they want it. And the demand is so huge that Temu and Shein can ferret it out and then find that sweater somewhere at a factory in China and fly it to them. So it stands to reason. When people can figure out how to have that level of customization closer to demand, more efficiently, with less negative environmental impact, eventually somebody's going to figure that out.
Yeah, and I think next step, they will come to the US and also to Europe to at least have some stock levels to reduce shipping costs, and then they will add it with the long tail directly from the factory. And this is, they're working on the model. That's quite obvious. But I think it's a good example. And you said it right. It's a new model. It's a new opportunity. But they are trying to solve it with old technology.
Using industrial age technologies. And that's a transitional thing. I think this is going to look very different in a decade.
Mm-hmm. And... okay, I promise one last question before we come to my industry. what do you think? Because in Germany we have a lot of saying about there is a trend of reshoring, so the industrial companies try to get more from close partners, but I do not see it. It was a trend when the war in Ukraine started, and everybody was talking about it, but the people do not live it. That's at least what I see. They still want to have the best purchasing price. And when you have this discussion, in addition with tariffs, maybe from a new legislation in the US, what is your take? Is this a trend that will help proximity in the future, or will it maybe push it back for a couple of years?
Well, as you know, Max, in the book, we talk about a number of catalysts that have been going on and will likely continue to go on that are pushing us in this direction. But note that a catalyst is different than the enabler. Digital technologies are what enable us to do these things closer to demand in an efficient, business-relevant way. We're not talking about just because it's fun or cool, it makes us more money. But geopolitics and severe climate events, those are catalysts that are encouraging people to look at things like producing closer to demand, like Interstellar Lab, producing for L'Oreal in their manufacturing facilities, or distributed energy resources, for instance. So rather than relying on a huge power plant miles and miles away, let's have multiple solar arrays or small-scale nuclear. Proximity predicts that small-scale nuclear will be a critical solution. It doesn't say anything about regulations. Proximity as a concept, regulation will either be for or against things, but geopolitical conflict is a catalyst for proximity. Severe climate events are catalysts for proximity. Pandemics are catalysts for proximity. So these just nudge us further in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you would say, if I look at topics like tariffs and geopolitical consequences or conflicts, then this is maybe... It doesn't help, but it doesn't block it. So it's more important to think about what is enabling, because everything that enables maybe can add value for the customer or the guy who is the demand. Okay.
Well, the digital technologies enable us to do this in ways that are business smart, but things like geopolitics catalyze companies and governments to think about how we can do more in country. To give a perfect example, Singapore, as you might know, has been focused on, I think they call it 30 by 30 or something like that. By 2030, they aspire to have a 30% of all of their food, all their nutrition grown in country. And remember, Singapore is a city state. They have very little land. So they're driving enormous investment in trying to understand how to grow and produce more nutrition right there in their own country. And that's for security, safety, dealing with geopolitical challenges, pandemics, et cetera. So you're going to see these things, these technologies get better and better to do things we could never have done before.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at my company, so because also more than 1 year ago, I visited you in New Jersey, and we had an afternoon, and I was asking you one question. I said, Rob, I understood the concept of proximity. What are the consequences for my business? So wholesale distribution of industrial parts.
Yeah.
And when I was reading the book, you also have the proximity strategy workbook in the appendix. And maybe to wrap it up, what would be maybe the three questions I should ask myself when I look at my business?
Great. So a couple of things. So Max, you're talking about the proximity strategy workbook, which is in the appendix of proximity. This is where Kaihan and I created a set of exercises and questions that any business leader, any investor can ask to say, where should we consider going in the future? It's a very applied part of the book to say, what might proximity mean for me or for my customers? So you know what? I'll fall back on the most important question that I've mentioned a couple times, which is, in the future, if my customers or my customers' customers, because if you're in the middle of a supply chain, you've got to be really concerned about what's downstream and upstream, not just your direct customers, because they might be disintermediated at some point. But in the future, if my customers or my customers' customers can have anything they want anywhere, what would they want? And the more aggressive you can get with that question, and when you're doing ideation, as you know, Max, don't let reality get in the way. When you're just sitting around thinking about the future, you're not investing money yet. You're just thinking. You're just ideating. And when you do this exercise, start by not letting reality get in the way. If my customers could have whatever they want, wherever and whenever they want it, what would it be? Now you can use that vision of could be a near-term future, could be a far future, but you can use that vision to work backwards to where you are today and say, what would need to change in order to get there? And one of the things you'll find, as we have found, is there'll be some things where you say, oh boy, that could take decades, maybe never in my lifetime. But you'll find other things where you say, you know what? We might actually be able to do that right now. We might be able to experiment with some very high value products that when our customers don't have access to them, it's catastrophic for them. We might be able to create systems to be imminently responsive wherever they are, and we're going to do it before the competition. That's what we need to do. So that's the question I would ask over and over again, and that question will help you stay ahead of where the world's going.
Okay, so really thinking about customer, what he really needs, and maybe in combination also about enabling technologies that could help, because this could help in for your to get creative. And there's also one sentence in the book. It's about what boundaries are close to fall down, or what boundaries will go away in future.
Yeah,
that's also that's the negative. I would say the negative approach to what is enabling me to do better. But I also think that if you are in very traditional old segments, that sometimes help. What boundaries do I have, and when they fall away, what chances do I get?
Well, actually, that I'm glad you pointed it out. We refer to those as constraints. Mm-hmm. And what humans just naturally do when they see something really new is they immediately fall back on the old paradigm, and they fall back on the constraints they already know. And they say, well, this will never happen because of X, right? Well, maybe, or maybe not. I'll give you an example we can all feel. Back during the dot-com boom of 98, 99, 2000, everything was gonna change, and then there was a crash, and everything fell apart, and people said, see, you know, Amazon can sell books and CDs, remember CDs? Books and CDs online, because you know it's standard, you know what you're getting. But nobody will ever buy shoes online. Remember that? Everybody was confident no one will ever buy shoes online. Guess what? They're buying shoes online all the time now. So you're talking about constraints. And what I recommend people do when they're doing these, thinking about the future, these exercises, is write out the constraints. Here are the constraints. Here's why we think this thing can't work or won't work or whatever. And then understand the constraint. Why does that constraint exist? What would have to change to release that constraint? And when you do that exercise, you start to realize, you know, not all constraints are created equal. And over time, we get better and better, and we solve these things.
And you just have to be open-minded and then maybe find possible solutions. So,
yes.
Rob, first of all, thank you for writing the book. So it took you 10 years, but I'm very happy about it.
Well, the writing only took about a year when we got to it. But yeah, the journey was about a decade.
it was a long journey, but I think it was worth it. Thank you also for taking you the time for the podcast. One maybe idea for the future is I would be happy because I gave out a couple of copies and I know a couple of people who bought the book. I would be happy to get more feedback from readers because I think it's a thought provoking book and I think it's important to get more feedback. What do you think about this idea to maybe collect feedback, or do you get feedback? What is the status?
Yeah, I would love to hear. If you hear interesting things, Max, send them my way. And I'd say to all your listeners, I'm always on LinkedIn. That's how I stay in touch with people. Obviously, you and I haven't, Max and I have met, but your listeners, we haven't met in person. But if you send me a connection request and say, hey, I met on Max Meister's podcast and I'd love to connect, I'm definitely going to say yes. I want to hear your thoughts, good and bad. I want to stress test this over and over again. And when we do that, we become better and we learn the nuances of this rapidly evolving world. So please reach out.
Okay, so this was what I was hoping for. Also, for my listeners, can always get in touch with me. And
if you're in New Jersey like Max was, let me know and come by and we'll get a cup of coffee at my favorite coffee shop, Ridgewood Coffee in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Yeah, it's a great coffee place. So, again, Rob, thank you. And please also thank to Kaihan. Very interesting. And I'm happy to stay in touch. And I will also give you some feedback that I get from this podcast. Great. And happy to be some small part of the journey because it's interesting. Yeah, thanks.
Well, vielen Dank, Max, and I look forward to our next meeting.